Journalist Sam Quiñones traveled from Mexico to main streets across the U.S. to report for his book Dreamland, True Tale of America's Opiate Epidemic. It was a New York Times bestseller and a groundbreaking portrait of the opioid epidemic that awakened the nation. In the years following that book's publication, Sam continued to crisscross the country, delivering talks to audiences desperate for insight and answers as the nation struggled to put back the pieces. Quiñones' travels revealed that the epidemic was far from over, in fact, was entering a dangerous new phase, synthetic drugs and a new generation of kingpins whose product could be made in magic bullet blenders. In fentanyl, traffickers landed a painkiller 100 times more powerful than morphine. He writes about this in his new book, The Least of Us. It is published by Bloomsbury, and we welcome Sam Quiñones to the roundtable this morning. Sam, thank you very much for being with us.
Great to be here, Joe. Thank you for having me on.
Very nice to have you on the program. What brought you to the subject to tell these particular tales?
Well, I started with my earlier book on this topic, which was really about the opioid epidemic being overprescribing of narcotic painkillers by doctors and promotion by drug companies, and that leading, in fact, to significant numbers of people getting addicted to those pills. And from there, some portion of those folks went on to become addicted to heroin. I wrote that book in 2015. It was called Dreamland. And after Dreamland came out, I began to do lots of speaking about the book all around the country because this was a national problem. And as I did that, I began to realize that the story was changing and that there was a new story really emerging, and that was the replacement of those pain pills largely by synthetic drugs produced by the underworld, the drug trafficking world in Mexico. And that meant that there was really, it was really a very different story than I had written for the Dreamland book. And at the same time, though, I wanted to really write about what I thought was an essential element in the way to fight this problem, which was to really begin to strengthen, rebuild, repair community around this country. Because I really came to believe doing Dreamland that the root of all this was how much we had done to shred community, to isolate ourselves, fragment our communities, and so on. And I felt that that was really the first step. Rebuilding that was really the first step towards it. So part of the book, The Least of Us, told the story of how the Mexican trafficking world got into synthetic drugs, methamphetamine and fentanyl. And then but more than half the book is really about stories of Americans in the smallest ways, daily ways, repairing community, rebuilding their towns, their streets, their neighborhoods, that kind of thing.
It seems, even looking at your last book and looking at this book, of how quickly that happened, of how quickly the synthetic drugs and this new generation of kingpins came on the scene and really entered this new phase that was really dreadfully dangerous.
Yes, it's absolutely. It's an interesting observation. That's very true. I would say, though, that the Mexican trafficking world had learned the benefits of synthetic drugs. That is, drugs that no plant involved, just made by chemicals only. Mm. They had learned those lessons really in the 1990s. What are the benefits of making your own drugs in a lab? You don't need land, rainfall, sunlight, irrigation, farmers. You just dispense completely with the traditional ways of producing drugs, which is growing them. And there's all kinds of benefits in terms of increased profitability, reduced risk, ease of production, all that kind of stuff. And then in the midst of the opioid epidemic, in a story that I tell in The Least of Us, the Sinaloa drug cartel discovered that there was such a thing as what they called synthetic heroin, meaning fentanyl. And they did this through an underground chemist that they hired really to make the precursor chemical to methamphetamine, a chemical known as ephedrine, this decongestant. They hired him to do that. They supplied his lab and all that. And he decided, you know, I know more than these guys. And he had gone to prison in the United States for making fentanyl. And he wanted to, he had a lot of new ways of making it. And so he decided to make that instead. they got angry when they found out, but then he told them, look, this is the most profitable, most potent drug you're ever going to deal with. And that was when fentanyl, there's a new drug for them, kind of the lights come on, that this is a new way of, they don't no longer need to grow poppies and so on. As it turns out, that chemist was quickly arrested, his lab was taken down, and so it was several years before the Mexican trafficking world really got back into fentanyl, but they never forgot about it. And so it was always there. Chinese companies were making the ingredients, and in a matter of maybe 8 to 9 years, the Mexican trafficking world gets into it, and they begin to make just staggering quantities of this drug, as well as methamphetamine. That's really the story of today in America. You have two drugs, a stimulant and a depressant, both made into staggering quantities because the trafficking world has access to these shipping ports in Mexico and ingredients from Mexico. They can make this stuff, and they've covered the country, really, with these two drugs, including in your area, which never really had much methamphetamine. Now you're seeing Mexican methamphetamine all over, as well as fentanyl.
When you were just telling that answer, you at the beginning of that time, you said that there was obviously increased profitability, but there was also reduced risk. How did they reduce the risk?
Well, generally speaking, it's because these are more compact drugs to smuggle. Certainly, fentanyl is you know, a kilo of fentanyl will yield, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars of profit done the right way in the trafficking world. Methamphetamine is a little bit more bulky, but it's certainly less bulky than, say, marijuana. And so so it was simply that it was easier to smuggle, easier to hide, because it's more compact. These drugs are more compact. It's also the fact that you can make these drugs in a laboratory or in a makeshift place in the middle of the countryside with the, you know, and they're not enormous extensions of land where you're growing marijuana. And so it's away from the prying eyes of helicopters. You can make this stuff much more easily with fewer people. All of this means reduced risk for traffickers and the people who are making this stuff.
The benefit for them, of course, is the money, the profitability. But doesn't at some point does it have to kill? I mean, does it have to be as fatal as it is? Is that something that they should take into account? Because I can't think that's good for business.
Well, it depends how you look at it. Honestly, certainly it's not good to kill your customers. On the other hand, when you produce a drug and people are addicted to it, particularly if it's an opioid, this was true of heroin too, by the way, that when somebody overdoses on an opioid, heroin, now fentanyl, normally what that means is that addicts run to that. It's not a warning. It's an advertisement for the potency of the drug. And so it's not necessarily a negative if someone overdoses on the drug that you just sold. In fact, some places I've talked with addicts who say that my dealer would advertise the fact that his dope put somebody on their butt, so to speak. And so they should be concerned about it, and I suspect some of them are. But in the long run, these are people who are making wholesale products. They're not dealing with the dealers on the street level. And I don't really think they care too much. And the truth is, though, that fentanyl is so potent, and the ability to mix fentanyl is so poorly understood and so difficult to achieve well, that the truth is that that there is really, in the long run, no safe way of selling fentanyl on the street illegally like they're doing. And there is a saying on the street among drug counselors, I heard this many a time, that there's no such thing as a long-term fentanyl addict. They all die. That was not true of heroin. Heroin people could last 34. I've met people who lasted 30, 40 years using heroin, and they don't die. That does not happen with fentanyl. It's essential to either get off the street or break or find some way of breaking from the drug, which is a very difficult thing to do. Otherwise, people end up dying.
Sam Quinones is the author of the book, The Least of Us, True Tales of America and Hope in the Time of Fentanyl and Meth. You write in the book that in a time when drug traffickers act like corporations and corporations like traffickers, our best defense, perhaps our only defense, lies in bolstering community. How so?
Well, I believe that the roots of our problem, as I said earlier, lie in the fact that we have done so much to just isolate ourselves as Americans in our community, shred what brought us together, avoid what brought us together, be kind of, now we're awkward when we're around other people. We don't know how to kind of be together. And my feeling has always been that community is the bulwark through which it's more powerful, really, than these drugs, except for we have weakened it so much. And in fact, if you think about it, the impulse, the instinct for community is bred into us from millennia of really it being the way we survive. In earlier times, the person who left the community and went off marching to the beat of his own trumpet got eaten or that was defenseless. So we evolved from people, from our ancestors understood and really needed that impulse to community. It's only in the modern day America, let's say 40 years or so, when we have really believed that that was not necessary. And indeed, it's hard. It's messy being around other people. We don't agree. They don't think like we do. We vote differently, et cetera, et cetera. There's all kinds of reasons why it would be difficult to be around other people. You had COVID is further separating us. You have social media, which is intended supposedly to connect us, and really what it does is, and most of the time it separates us. You have cable TV doing quite the same thing. All of that is kind of what has left us, in my opinion, very without defenses against these drugs, because these drugs really live in our own isolation. That's a natural habit. When I was talking about heroin, used to say heroin's natural habitat is our own isolation. That's how it thrives. And to me, that is really what we have created in the United States in so many ways that we could go on and on. And many books about this are written, how isolated, how alone. And of course, then you have the other symptoms of that, which are suicide, depression, friendlessness, loneliness, all these kinds of things. But I believe opioid addiction, just drug addiction in general, kind of an outgrowth of that as well.
I mean, I'd like to touch on that. I mean, it seems essential that if we're going to take care of this problem, we have to understand why people want to take these drugs in the first place, even knowing the inherent risks, right? It is to kill that pain from, yes, the loneliness or the mental health issue or whatever it may be, but it is to alter that reality.
I think generally speaking, that's true. There's also enormous amounts of trauma involved. You know, what I think this addiction epidemic has shown, has lifted the lid on, is really a national deep reservoir of trauma, rape, incest, molestation, beating, neglect, et cetera, et cetera. Et cetera.
Right.
It's remarkable when you see the life stories of a lot of people, how even in poor neighborhoods, middle-class neighborhoods, wealthy neighborhoods, it doesn't matter. There's still this reservoir of trauma. And also, you know, we live now within our lifetimes. We have seen a radical change, and that is the number of products that are now masterfully marketed to us legally, that are legal products that are intensely addictive: sugar, gambling, pornography, video games, social media. Of course, you could go on and on about that. We live in a toxic soup of addictive stuff that is masterfully, again, marketed to us. And at the end of that panorama, if you look across that, at the end, that's where you find the Sinaloa drug cartel. But all of these groups, all these industries, all these very, very expert and intelligent people who are hired by these companies to prod our brain chemistry into obeying kind of our impulses. Yes, I want that. I need that. I have to have that. that is also, I think, part of this story and what also kind of facilitates, I think, a lot of the drug use. So it's a complicated panorama, but it all gets back, I think, really to the fact that as Americans, we frequently are just so alone. The community bonds have been so shredded. And again, this is in poor neighborhoods, Rust Belt neighborhoods, economically devastated neighborhoods, and wealthy middle-class neighborhoods all across the spectrum. It doesn't seem to be one part of the country alone. It's the common denominator is isolation, seems to me.
So the efforts that we have taken that you write about in the book to restore community and embracing the forgotten and the ignored, this is where you see hope.
Oh, absolutely, I do. Yeah, and I see that because I've spent time at the very, very most local level. And when you get down to those levels, you see that the so-called intractable polarization that we see fomented and aggravated by Twitter and cable TV news and CNN and Fox News and all that kind of stuff. It really is not the major issue that we've been told it is. We're kind of trained now to believe that this is an intractable problem. My feeling is the closer you get to the streets, to the local communities, to the houses of worship, to the basic areas where people live their lives, you find that people don't, that's not as important as, and you find people working in the smallest ways, the least sexy ways, but also the most constructive ways at rebuilding their neighborhood. And what we need to do, it seems to me, it really does seem to me that we need to recognize that. We need to spend a lot of time. I think politicians would do enormous good in this country if they would find those efforts and spend a lot of time casting light on them, giving people hugs, encouraging them, you know what I mean?
Right.
To build this up, because what's also true is when you spend time at this most local, you find that everybody wants it. Everybody wants to be kind of outdoors with their neighbors just a little bit more because we've been in, but it's awkward. We don't know how to do it so much as we used to and that kind of thing. And so we need to kind of have it kind of planned for us in a weird way, I think. And so, but all of this, I think, can provide the bulwark to combating these absolutely poisonous drugs that are spreading across the country right now.
And as you just described it, I mean, that is not a being supportive, having empathy. These are not things that have high price tags.
It doesn't have to be, I don't think. Yeah, I think it's frequently low tech, frequently on the most basic level, and understanding that you know, we all benefit when we establish those community contacts and we make the neighborhood just a little bit tighter and more able to defend itself from these social problems. Doesn't have to be, you know, can be the smallest little thing, like having barbecues and getting
right
out of the house, for goodness sake. My God, it's like the entire United States decided to go indoors. And I've seen this in the town where I grew up in Southern California, where when I grew up in the 60s, there was clumps of kids every afternoon outside and clogging the park. I mean, it's a very well-used park. Now there's just nobody on the street, nobody in the parks. It's a sad, sad thing. And I believe this is kind of just emblematic of what has caused and what has been really the petri dish of this kind of epidemic of addiction that we've been facing.
Sam Quinones is the author of The Least of Us, Two Tales of America and Hope in the Time of Fentanyl and Meth. The book is published by Bloomsbury. Sam, thank you very much for being with us. A great pleasure to have you on the program.
Thanks very much, Joe. Good of you to have me on.
Thank you very much. Again, the name of the book is The Least of Us, True Tales of America and Hope in the Time of Fentanyl and Meth. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.